Hello, everybody. Welcome to the session now before lunch. I'm very pleased to welcome Stephanie, who's from Advanced Learning Solutions, IMC, who's going to do our session. What's it titled? E-Learning Iceberg, the Invisible Reasons for Success or Failure. So what I just ask is we're going to have a bit of a question session at the end. If anybody really has to ask a question, you need to wait for me to get down to you with this microphone because we're recording everything. So we want to be able to really capture the question that's asked well for anybody who's listening to it afterwards. So I'll hand over now to Stephanie. Thank you very much. It'll be a great session.
Well, thanks for the introduction and thanks for your interest in this session. I know Casey Moore is running in parallel, so I appreciate your interest in coming here. As mentioned just now, my name is Stephanie and I am working for a company named IMC. We are Europe's largest e-learning provider, and earlier this year we launched our regional office in Sydney. So that's why the framework people ask us to maybe share some of the experiences that we gathered during the last 15 years, ever since we were founded in Europe with you. And that's what I'm intending to do. So let's start the presentation. It's called E-Learning Iceberg, the Visible Invisible Reasons for Success and Failure. And in this session, I would like to have a closer look at the reasons why e-learning implementations tend to fail or to succeed. I will show you some best practices for each of the components or for each of the factors that I'm going to talk about. I've tried very much to make this a completely vendor and product neutral presentation. I'm just going to talk about the best practices from our customer base, but even there I'll try to reduce any kind of product related information. I simply thought I'll integrate some best practices because they offer you a chance to better illustrate your points. Okay. When IMC was founded, the founder was a professor of information technology who until today is quite a renowned voice for business process management. So our working approach from the beginning was very much process oriented. And until today, one of the main approaches that our consultants apply when they visit potential clients or clients is the so-called learning life cycle. As you can see in this picture, the learning life cycle names and categorizes all processes related to the implementation of e-learning. It shows shows all the processes which organizations should consider when they want their e-learning projects to work. And as you can see, the implementation of e-learning is not just about learning processes, such as how will tutoring and teaching work in my new learning environment? Who is responsible for the administration of the system? Which communication and collaboration tools do I want to make available? Or how will I manage my resources? It's also about human resource management processes, human resource development. How do I organize knowledge management? And it's about content development. Who will be doing the authoring? How will we manage editing and updating of the content? And in addition, you have the overall planning, controlling, and evaluation of all these processes. Now, based on this learning life cycle, many years ago, IMC has come up with an approach called the e-learning iceberg. We noticed that when implementing e-learning, most organizations are aware of only very few of these processes that I just showed in the earlier slides. The obvious ones, the ones, as we term it, above the surface. For example, which features shall the learning environment offer? How shall the solution be integrated into the existing IT infrastructure? Or most of them even knew how the solutions should look like with regards to design and corporate identity. But when you want your e-learning projects to work, even those factors beneath the surface are critical for your success. Just a few here, like how do I roll out this new solution? How to address the users in order to increase my acceptance level of the new technologies? Or where does my content come from? If you, for example, ask a television station in January, what are you going to broadcast in December? Most of them will be able to tell you by the minute what they're going to broadcast. But when you ask organizations, what's your content strategy for the next 2 years? You very rarely get an answer to that. Another question could be, who is responsible for the change management? As much as we believe that processes in organizations should not follow the IT implemented, but every new system automatically implies a certain change to your standard processes or to the processes existing in the organizations. Now, these are just examples. The amount of aspects above or beneath the surface, they differ significantly from one organization to another. However, we rarely found organizations who've really thought it all through. And the result is quite obvious. Quite a significant number of organizations have made rather disappointing experiences with e-learning. They considered it inefficient with respect to time or budgets. They were disappointed with the user acceptance rate, or they were simply disenchanted. Probably all of you have shared this kind of feelings in one or the other way. So in this session, I would like to take a closer look at a few selected from my opinion, or based on my opinion, the most important aspects. There won't be sufficient time to discuss all of them. Specifically, even this chart is not 100% complete, but I'm going to pick three and I'm quickly having a look at them, giving some best practices, and then maybe even formulating some recommendations. So the first aspect I would like to talk about is the learning strategy. One of the main risks when implementing e-learning is that the learning strategy is not in line with the overall company strategy. There usually is or should be a reason for implementing e-learning. And this reason should be derived from the corporate strategy. For example, the organizational strategy foresees to increase the level of self-paced and self-responsible learning. So e-learning is implemented as a driver to achieve this objective. Or maybe a more realistic scenario in these days. The objective is to reduce training costs because budgets are limited. So e-learning is considered to be a cost-effective alternative to face-to-face trainings. In both of these cases, the learning strategy has to be built upon the business case underlying the need for the e-learning implementation. For example, if the business need is to reduce the cost of training, organizations should implement a very, very basic infrastructure and should refrain from a number of modules or functionalities that are not needed. Because if you implement the biggest solution available in the market, it will eventually not reduce your training costs, but probably increase them. These are some considerations that should take place before you actually start with the implementation projects. But often these considerations don't take place. And even more often, e-learning solutions are implemented with their full range of functionalities. That causes what I call over-abilities, one of the main reasons why people are completely dissatisfied with their e-learning solutions. And these over-abilities, again, create very, very high process complexity and interdependences between the different parties involved. So before we come to a conclusion, let's have a look at a best practice. When I joined IMC, that's approximately 3 years ago, in order to get to know our business, one of my first tasks was to travel to all our customers and conduct interviews, and then later write case studies about this, based on these interviews. And one of my favorite examples, or one of my favorite interviews, was one with BASF. I'm not sure if that name tells you something. It's the largest chemical company in the world, and they employ around 100,000 employees all around the world. In 2006, they came up or have formulated a corporate strategy which was called BASF 2015. And they clearly said that all corporate decisions have to be based upon that corporate strategy. One of the components of this strategy was to increase the level of what they called self-organized and self-motivated learning among their workforce. They clearly formulated their expectations towards their employees. Each employee is required to continuously update and refresh his knowledge in order to allow BASF to play an important role in the world, even in 2050 still. This concept of self-motivated learning is based on the idea that each learner knows him or herself best, better than any supervisor or any line manager could ever do. So it should be left, that's what they believe in, to the hands of the learner to decide which competencies is he lacking, which courses should he be visiting in order to fill these competencies gaps. What does the learner think should be the competence or the abilities that he should have in order to make BASF compatible in 2015? Of course, they didn't leave the learner alone with all this. They set up so-called learning centers at each major location. Inside there, learners could go and they would find a lot of learning resources such as books, games, videos. These centers were fully equipped. They had a relaxing area where the learner could withdraw in order to read or to watch a video or a movie. There were a number of seminars offered, and they were ranging from, I still remember, modern Chinese up to martial arts. And it was completely up to the learner to decide which of these he's going to visit. There were consultants there which would help learners who were not sure to define, for example, their learning style, to get recommendations on the learner knows where he wants to be, but he didn't know which steps to take. So there were consultants supporting the learners. But in the end, the decision was left to each employee. Of course, an online platform was part of this overall concept. It's called European Learning Portal. And again, all courses were freely accessible to the staff, and they could decide which one they want to subscribe in. Now, the curious part of this best practice is that this learning infrastructure that they implemented, the online solution, was a very, very basic one. One of the most basic ones that we have ever implemented. There were no fancy aspects about it, no web to zero functionalities, no virtual classroom, really nothing special. But it won many, many awards, awards by the German government, by the European Union, and so on. And surprisingly, even the internal acceptance rate of this solution was extremely high. Now, that really surprised me, because in a company with so many people working in factories, not many people having access to their own computer every day anyway, I would have assumed that it takes a lot of convincing and a lot of goodwill to get people to use this platform. Specifically, since there was for nobody a very pressing need to do so. But when they launched it, and they rolled it out via an internal marketing strategy, I still remember that day, that's not part of the best practice. They had foreseen about 5,000 people on the first day, so the platform was scaled for that, and it crashed within the first 2 hours of going live. So please delete that from your memory. But what I'm trying to say is that the people responded, and there's a reason why I was impressed, why the people responded, why they won awards with such a simple and basic technology. And that reason is simply they had a vision, they had a strategy, and their infrastructure simply served the purpose of enhancing, supporting this strategy. That's why they were successful, in my opinion. So, what is the conclusion? It's definitely not by Apple, but it is follow the example of the iPod. I'm using the iPod here as a metaphor, simply because, in my opinion, the iPod is one of the best examples for the perfect product strategy. It's very basic in its functionalities, if we are honest. But still, every user, everybody I'm talking to, is convinced that the iPod offers exactly what he or she needs. At the time it was brought into the market, there were many more, much better or more sophisticated MP3 players. So what did Apple do? They obviously had a team which analyzed the core functionalities of MP3 players and what is really needed, and they did not invest their resources in adding more and more functionalities, but in making these basic functionalities very sexy, very appealing to people, and that's the basis of their success. Now, how can we move this metaphor from the iPod into our day-to-day business? Learning infrastructure are very, very flexible today. They can be adapted to almost any application scenario or corporate strategy. For example, through modular structures, most of the learning technologies out there can be purchased. Like, for example, you buy the basic functionality and you add modules for additional functionalities. So, for example, there, like, when we talk about learning management systems, you've got the delivery aspect is one module, and you can just purchase additional features, additional functionalities to it, like resource management, report design. That's a standard offer out there in the market. So there is software which can grow with your business needs and which can help you to avoid these so-called over-abilities. But in order to select the functionalities and abilities that your solution should be offering, you have to formulate a very detailed and specific business case for your learning infrastructure. For our consultants, that's usually one of the main parts of their work is not so much on implementing it, but it's actually on defining the business case with the customers. Because in the end, even we as technology providers, we won't benefit from over-able solutions because people get frustrated and they'll never come back to us. Okay, so that's on learning strategy. The next point I quickly want to talk about is the operating model. I think one of the most common frustration that I hear when I talk to people is definitely based on the fact that organizations make usually available a big amount of money in the beginning when they implement new infrastructure, when they implement new learning technologies, but they lack an ongoing concept of how to operate these structures, these technologies. Once you have invested in the infrastructure and the hardware and everything that comes along with it, that's by far not the end of it. You'll then have to administer the system. There's the question of content development. How are you going to guarantee that your content is always up to date? It may take quite a while for you until your investment materializes. So you have to develop an operating concept that allows you to survive for this period of time. A few weeks ago, I visited an NGO in Sydney, very small organization, and they told me that they decided, for example, for Moodle, because they thought, or they said, the argument was, that's the cheapest solution. It doesn't cost us. And I told her that I sincerely question that decision, not because I want to sell something to her. That was not our line of business for what she wanted to use that, but simply because I believe that she did not sit down and really analyze the cost of now and in the future of her Moodle solution, because they are a very, very small organization with almost no IT administration, and they have very irregular training needs. So I said to her that I question that Moodle is the best choice for them. In many cases, Moodle is the best choice, but in this specific case, I questioned it. But this argument of it doesn't cost, or it doesn't cost in the beginning, which may be even true, but it lacked the long-term perspective. The practice example for this aspect is from the Department of Health in UK. The Department of Health has set up a group which was called E-Learning for Healthcare, whose task it is to produce and distribute e-learning content, e-learning modules to healthcare professionals all around UK. This group will identify training needs, develop curricula, and eventually produce the content and distribute it via an online platform. And just to give you some numbers, they have programs which consist of up to 500 individual modules. Sorry, I just saw the dog. they altogether they administer about 6,000 different modules. But I think the most impressive number is that they were looking for a solution for initially 500,000 people, which will grow up to 3 million people in the end after a term of about 2 years. Now, for us, the most surprising aspect when we received the request for tender were these numbers, of course, but the most surprising thing was that they were not looking for a solution to host themselves. They were looking for an externally hosted solution. Now, it's common understanding even among the technology providers that usually the smaller organization, they would go for hosted solutions, and the larger ones, they would probably, it's more beneficial for them to purchase the licenses and implement it at their own premises. So I called when I prepared this presentation, I called the project manager and I asked him, why did they choose such an operating model? And he said, they really sat down, made a very, very detailed analysis of the cost that's coming up if they maintain the structure, infrastructure, if they guarantee a certain availability, if they have to answer questions and so on. And the result of their analysis was that it is cheaper for them to give this to external people to host it, where they've got the flexibility. If they're not happy with the system, they just call and say, listen, after this whatever months, please terminate the contract. They can request an availability, and if it's not there, they simply, there are fines involved and everything like that. So what I'm trying to say, there are many means of transport, and it may not be necessary or even economical for you or for organizations to purchase and maintain their own lorry, which in our example would be to purchase and implement your own learning infrastructure at your own premises. There may not even be the need to lease a car, which I would compare with a hosted solution where somebody else is hosting it on their hardware and middleware and so on. Sometimes maybe the most economic way to travel is buying a ticket in a train whenever you need it. Now, for example, in our analogy here, that would be what is now been newly introduced by some vendors, the cloud computing concept or software as a service, where all you do is pay an initial setup fee, let's say, I don't know, it will vary, but between 1,000 to 2,000 Australian dollars, something like that. And then you just pay, as you use the system, an amount of 1 to 2 Australian dollars per course booking. And in months where you don't need the system, you have no cost. And in months where you've got an intensive use, you've got higher costs. But always the costs are related to your activities. Another example is it may not be necessary to always travel business class, to always produce content or very fancy content, you may simply not have the budget for that. So develop a content strategy which allows certain content to be produced, maybe externally with a lot of rich content elements, and maybe you get some rapid authoring tools, some freeware on the net or whatever, and distribute it among your trainers to record their training sessions and produce some content on in this way. Okay, so that's the operating model. And the last aspect I want to talk about, and then we are through with this presentation, and then we've got some time for questions, is the target group of your e-learning projects. I'm always surprised to find out that very few organizations really know the preferences or the likings of their target groups. Even though this data very often is collected via feedback forms, via personal talks in the workforce, the data collected is very rarely analyzed with regards to the question, what do we have to change in order to ensure an ongoing engagement of our learners? We all know that there's very, very little time available in our daily routine for learning. So even more important it is that we have a very clear picture of all our target groups and of their preferences and their preferred way of learning. One of the companies that I have met, which is fully aware of the preferences of their target groups, is VW. They have implemented a learning management system back in 2003. And from the beginning, they implemented a very target group specific concept for their learning infrastructures. They have a highly diverse workforce. They have top managers, and they even have, which surprised me very much, quite a significant number of butchers, for example, because they decided at one point that in order to buy sausages and meat for the canteens externally, they rather set up their own butcher, however you call that. So their workforce is really highly diverse, with a lot of people working at the construction belt, with a lot of people, like all the people spread around the world. So they said that they won't be successful if they roll out this learning solution all together at one time. So they choose one target group, which was the top managers. They implemented the learning solutions for them first, which gave them time to gain experiences with this target group and draw logical next steps for the target groups to follow from these experiences. Last year only, so that's about 6 years or 5 to 6 years, it took them to roll it out throughout the whole family of companies. They implemented it to the last group, which would be the construction belt workers. By that time, they knew that these people have very, very limited access to computers and are not really very IT savvy in most cases. So what they did is they appointed 300 so-called education coordinators, which they placed at the main locations. And the task of these education coordinators was to support the construction belt workers, the factory workers, with their online learning, to make computers available when they want to learn, to help them where to click, how to communicate with others in a chat or forum. And by this, ensure that they will follow this path that the human resource development team has foreseen. Now, when you have very, very diverse target groups, maybe, for example, sales managers are more likely to respond to mobile learning or pure e-learning modules, as they're always traveling and have very little time at hand to attend face-to-face trainings. Factory workers may still respond mainly to face-to-face offerings. So in order to find the perfect mix for between e-learning, mobile learning, social learning, blended learning, etc. for your employees, we have to analyze their preferences and tailor target group-specific learning scenarios. And we have to have a learning infrastructure which supports all of these learning scenarios. Now, a lot of us may not have the time and resources for all of these considerations at the beginning of our projects. So we may just follow the example of VW and take each step at a time, starting with the target groups that we know most about, and so working our way through our entire workforce. So this was my presentation. These were some selected aspects of e-learning implementations. Now we have some time for questions, if there should be any. You're all sleeping already.
Don't be shy.
Sorry, was I speaking too quickly? No questions? It's all... Maybe you don't have questions. Maybe you want to share some of your experiences with the rest of us. Maybe you just want to say, yeah, we've experienced this. Or maybe we found another solution. I'm not saying that what I presented today is the only way it could work. I'm sure there are many more ways. And oh, yeah, there.
How did VW go about working out what the preferred way of learning was for the people on the production line?
Yes. They did, of course, first they did some questionnaires, some talks with representatives, but then they did trial versions. You know, they rolled it, before they rolled it out big scale, because to them rolling out big scale is a lot of money. So what they did is they developed some testing materials, and they've worked with a testing group first across all countries. So, and then they would work on their feedback, simply the user acceptance and the user feedback that they would gain from there. It took time. That's what I said. It took 5 to 6 years to come to this point, from when they started with the top management until they covered the entire workforce. So it's definitely not, it wasn't a very quick process. Yeah. Any further comments, questions, ideas? Yes,
Further to that last question was, I guess having 300 staff to implement that strategy, they may not have identified it as their preferred mode, but they realised that if they were going to go down that track of implementing an e-learning strategy, that they needed to support them.
Yes,
to
yes.
make it work.
That was one of the results which turned out that when they did the trials, they actually figured out that it just wouldn't work that way when you leave these people alone with it. You know, they feel lost. You may not reach them with your message. So that's why one part of the implementation strategy eventually was to give them people at hand in order to get this corporate strategy work. Yeah. There was a... Oh, please.
I've got one here.
First that direction before.
Just tell us more about this company. I think it said VW and their employees being butchers.
I was really surprised. They do have... Now, you laugh about this. VW is the largest sausage producer in Germany. I really had to laugh very much about this. I didn't know until I visited their headquarters. It's in Wolfsburg in the north of Germany. And they were talking about their very diverse workforce. And I knew that it would be rather diverse until he started talking about the butchers. And what happened there was, quite a number of years ago, they were producing sausages and meat, for their, canteen. That's the English word. For their canteens. Now, these sausages became so famous that throughout Germany, people are talking of the VW curry sausage. So that's why they started a business out of that. which I found really very amusing, which hardly anybody knows, that they are the largest, if not one of the largest, sausage producers in Germany, which is really amazing, but they are large, yeah. There was another question on this side.
I really liked your presentation in that you were bringing to the front the underlying human resources, the people learning management side of it.
Yeah.
There's often been the lack of support from the bottom up.
Yes, yes.
For the management. And whenever I say, what would you be supporting with bottom up? You'd be supporting staff sharing ideas between themselves.
Yeah.
The management enabling the staff to develop their own resources in Moodle, give them the time and the resources to upskill themselves. I really like the way you gave that example of the staff were listened to and a pathway was developed to help them get to where they wanted to go. So in terms of management, my question is, what was it that you started out first with management? Because I think that's the key to get them used to supporting their staff.
I have visited really at that time when I conducted all these interviews, which was more of an introductory task for me, but I have visited a number of organizations, not necessarily only those where it really became such a success, like in those three examples that I presented. And I must say, I really found that top management support is the ultimate key to success. I've not seen a project work without that, honestly. The middle management, the line managers, they are the one who can implement that. They are the one who can support the top management decision. But they, for some reasons, their influence onto their employees is never strong enough if they do not have the backing of the top management. I'm really speaking about the top management. This has to be a vision of the organization. Only then I saw it really work. And I saw examples where it's been, where a lot of money was made available for implementations, but the top management was completely indifferent. They just couldn't care about it. And these projects failed. Even though the middle management and the, don't know how you call that, but and everybody in the workforce was really behind this idea. But when the top management is not behind it, it starts with, when there is a tough time, these budgets will be cut first. So everything you've worked for years will go down the drain. Whereas if the top management has understood that learning is such a crucial process in order to keep the company on track, then they will not cut, or they will cut the budgets. I mean, every department may have to suffer in bad times, but they will not, like, completely take budgets away from the learning people in such times. That's where it starts, but it goes much further. For some reasons, it seems to be really important to the workforce that this message is communicated. And I think it is very, very important to understand, why am I learning? You know, what is in there for me? And if the top management clearly says, well, in there for you is an ongoing place in our organization, or in there for you is being part of an even more successful company in the future, then people may understand. That's what I experienced. And I've seen really people struggling without that support. I found it very difficult.
And just quickly, one other thing. In terms of addressing that reality to success, it seems to me that there is a skills gap for the top management, and culturally, from the research, it seems that top management aren't prepared to in many cases to make the time to learn about the basics of, like, say, what a learning management system is.
Yeah.
You know, what are the actual issues around training flexibly?
Maybe they don't need to learn that, but they just need to understand. I mean, I'm quite sure that not every top manager or decision maker in a company does have the time to go into the detailed level. But if they understand the business case for it, if they understand the case, I mean, you know, if they support this case, I think that is crucial for success. I don't think it's very important that all of them, they don't have the time to go into the detailed level, but they can give directions, for other decision makers to travel along, and they can formulate strategies and visions.
Can I make a comment to the last questioner, whom I can't see, apologies. One of the things about top management training or education is that the managers work in an oral environment.
Yeah.
And the further down the organisational structure one goes, the greater the reliance on text.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Mobile devices and what have we, which can throw sound bites and remain in the oral type, if you will, may be more appropriate for these otherwise time-poor individuals.
Yeah.
My question to you is, given your experience in Europe with such a large organisation, now increasingly in Australia, to what extent does IMC and your experience with them try to capitalise on informational byproducts as a part of the implementation of e-learning? Now, what I mean is, one of the benefits of going down a digital pathway is that whilst you may get the job done, you also get the opportunity to record.
Yes.
That's an informational byproduct.
Yeah.
We come to this conference, we hear the people talk, we get the content, if you will, but we also get the human analogy, and that is experience. And I've not heard anyone talk about this idea of capturing informational byproducts to feed into further strategic planning to improve training overall, given the budgetary considerations. Could you make some comments about that?
Yeah, I tried to answer that. I hope I understood it right. If not, please correct me. We are currently working on a concept to actually open up our learning infrastructures, our learning management system, which is a big step for us as a learning management system provider. We want to open it up. We want to make it open social compatible, in order to allow external resources and whatever maybe
byproduct.
In order to integrate external byproducts, such as like all kind of social media. So far, learning infrastructures, when they were implemented at organizations, they were very closed systems. Like, they wouldn't integrate Twitter, they would have their own microblogging, they wouldn't integrate Facebook or other byproducts out there. So with this, we try to open the systems up, which so far nobody has done yet, to integrate external resources and to allow information that's been gathered by our learning management system to be communicated outside. A lot of times with such byproducts or external resources or whatever, security is the main issue. So that's what we are currently working on, to make such infrastructure secure. Does that answer your question? No.
Perhaps I wasn't clear enough. So
sorry.
My apologies to you. A really basic example is that many people, many organisations develop websites, web pages, and in the initial stages of doing so, they put it out there, but they have no way of understanding how many people have actually used that resource.
Yeah.
So somebody came up with the idea of putting a counter to track the number of hits.
Yeah.
Now, that tracking device is an informational byproduct. It gives you meta level of information about the use of that resource. Now, by way of trying to clarify, what I'm asking you is, when you design e-learning resources, to what extent, in your experience, are these massive undertakings of 5 or 6 years and I would imagine mega euro dollars building in a facility that allows for the capture of information about the use of those systems so that it then becomes an economic resource? Is that making it clearer?
Yes.
If I can just go a bit further to your sausage. interest. they found that the sausages were strongly enough bought by VW people, and
yes,
those externally, to make it a whole line of business.
Yeah.
Information can become another commercial revenue raiser if you capture it and use it wisely. Yeah. E-learning may well benefit from understanding this better than currently is the case.
I'm sorry for misunderstanding your question earlier. The level of what I would call information gathering strongly depends from organization to organization, but at least our tools allow all kind of information to be like all kind of how many people are visiting this content from which department, even on the content use, on specific content use, up to at what time did they log in or... All kind, you can actually define which kind of information you want to gather. It's almost all built in already. So yes, we have a lot of, like we accommodate that idea of information gathering, but the amount of use in organization, it really strongly differs. It's also sometimes you've got a lot of issues. Our products can do that, but a lot of organizations have issue with data protection. Yeah, so not all the information that we would like to gather or we would like to collect or publish can actually be used in order to protect the specific users. Does that answer it a little bit? Yeah. One over there then.
Thank you. I really liked your presentation.
Thank you.
I don't know if you can answer this or not.
I'll try.
When you spoke about the BASF example, you said they used an internal marketing strategy.
Yes.
Do you know what they did?
Oh, yes. Yes. I've got some ideas, not many, but they, it was, they used, how did they do it? Let me think for a moment. It was very playful, the internal marketing strategy, I remember that. They developed, how do you call this? Like a pet representing, and the pet had an Einstein head, something like that. Very funny. And that pet, they had these people walking around in big costumes, you know, in front, and they were handing out all kind of leaflets. And they really got through to these people, obviously. So it was, they wrote, the marketing campaign was playful in every way. They had, at some locations, they built small carousels, you know, some roller coasters. So, and everything was related to the message of there's something new. Why don't you, like, take the ride with us when it came to the roller coaster? Or that's what I remember. I don't remember how much, or I don't know. I simply never knew how much it cost or something, but everything they did was more, it wasn't very information-based. It was more on communicating again. They just had the headline. You know, it wasn't like on the leaflets, you just see, I remember them, you just see the headline, which I can't remember, and then just click on to. That's more or less it. And everything they did was very just playful with not very information-based, yeah. Ah, yeah, sorry, there was another one. In front here.
There was one factor which was listed on the slide which you didn't touch upon was access right. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Oh, yes.
What does that mean, access right?
You mean in the iceberg?
Yeah.
Access rights, if you have a piece of content, you usually can define very specifically who, or most learning management systems do allow you to define very complex access rights or even subscription processes. For example, in order, if you've got a content, it's the same with emails. Sometimes today a lot of our resources are eaten by the fact that we get too many emails which are not addressed to us and actually don't really matter to us, but we are on CC because it's so easy to copy everything to everybody. And it's the same with content. We experience that some people do have, like, they produce the content and then just more or less make it freely available, when actually they don't really, or a lot of people don't really need to watch that piece of content. So in our opinion, it's important to simply have an access right concept, and you can implement that by you can define groups or make it on an individual user basis. It depends on the size of your organization. Either you say the marketing department is one group, and then that piece of content is only allowed to be viewed by the marketing department, for example. That's one aspect of access rights. There is another aspect, which I just mentioned, subscription processes. When we started to design our learning management system many, many years ago, more than 10 years ago, we had, I think, one or two basic subscription processes. Either self-subscription, you choose the content and you watch it or whatever you do with it, or the supervisor can do it. And over the years, by now it's 7 registration processes implemented, and the requests for more is enormous. And we are trying to propagate a concept which we call simplexity, which is simplicity and complexity. It's the right mixture between it, because we had requests from customers which said, okay, I need the subscription process has to be like this. Somebody can subscribe by him or herself, but if, let's say, a woman and a man subscribe at the same time, because women should be preferred according to some laws, the man has to be rejected and the woman has to get that space in that course, for example. Yeah, but if a VIP man, you know, and if that VIP man is then related to our CEO, so we had like sometimes 20 different or 20 layered registration process for courses. That's another thing that if I were to discuss access rights, I would discuss with people if such complex scenarios are really necessary. So that few ideas. There are much more ideas which, when it comes to access rights, you can discuss, but that are some ideas to that point, yeah. No further question or ideas? One, hello? Yes, just.
Look, I'd just like to say, you know, your presentation wasn't wonderful. And I'd also like to support your statement earlier where, excuse me, where you indicated that, you know, if a product is stated to be a free product, to be cautious, to analyse your needs.
Yes.
Because from our experience, we can certainly say no product is free.
Yes.
You know, you need to take into consideration the resources that you will be utilising to maintain, manage, contextualise or customise the product. So
yeah.
You need to think about that before you make your decision.
Yeah. I very often experience that people, when it comes to this, don't really believe me because I'm coming from a professional or from a commercial, not professional, commercial is the word, technology provider. But I must say that open source products like Linux has never been a real danger to Windows. To us, we were never, that's not our line of business. We've got a different line of business. It's very, people who go with a commercial provider, they are, like, for them, different aspects are important. So we really never felt threatened. It's really about, it's really about what is best for our customer. And we don't even mind implementing a Moodle solution if the customer thinks that's best. But I'm just trying to urge people to think about that, that's all. I'm not saying Moodle is bad, Moodle is good. I'm not saying anything of that. I'm just saying, please believe me that it needs consideration, that's all. But sometimes I know that people think, well, from a commercial provider, what else do you expect? But opposition to open source. But I can only say that that has never been a motivation. We've been threatened by, I don't know, by economic crisis, but never by open source software because it's different application scenarios. Yeah. What's the time? I've lost completely my sense of time.
Good question. Well, the time's 22, so we're just about done.
Okay.
Yeah. So are there no more questions? Well, I'd particularly like to thank you
thank
for
you.
Your presentation. And everyone, give you a round of applause.
Thank you.